Hello!
Hello!
And welcome to the ADHD Science Podcast.
Or welcome back if you've been listening to our other episodes.
Yes, indeed. We have some recurring listeners. In fact, quite a lot of recurring listeners. And the listenership, I don't obsess about it, but it is, you know, creeping up quite nice. We've got, you know, thousands of downloads. We do want people to listen, and we want people... I mean, the most important thing you can do is to tell people about it if you like it.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth is the most powerful thing. We don't advertise particularly.
Also, like, who would trust us? We're the people who make the podcast. Like, if someone came up to you and went, I make the best podcast in the world, you'd be like, yeah, okay.
Yeah, it's exactly.
If someone said to you, these people make the best podcast in the world, which we do, you'd be more likely to take their word for that.
I think that's true. Anyway, so please do tell your friends if you have...
And spread the word.
Yeah. If you would like to spread the word about ADHD science and how important it is.
We'll be going global, like this person.
Hey!
Look at that link.
Very good.
Who is Australian.
Yes. Andrew Haig from Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Andrew talked a lot to us about attention, and what he really did was dive into what attention actually is.
Yeah.
And... in doing so, sort of talked a bit about what consciousness is, which is kind of where he came into the subject. It's just a really fascinating chat.
A great time.
A lot of the chats we have are kind of practically based on how we treat things and how we prevent stuff. But this was very much more kind of, well, what does it mean to be attention? And that was fascinating, and that's definitely got its place. So I don't think there's anything else we need to particularly say.
No.
Let's get on with listening to Andrew and also some of us.
Go ahead, Andrew.
Bye. Okay, welcome.
Welcome.
We are joined by Andrew Haig. Andrew did his master's at Townsville University in Queensland. And Townsville, by the way, looks lovely, but he also lives in Queensland, which looks even lovelier, and works in rehabilitation as a psychologist. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
So we're just going to crack on and go. We've been chatting offline quite a bit, so we're going to crack on and ask about your research.
Okay,
let's dive right in. So in your research, what question were you answering?
Well, I was looking at links between ADHD, obviously, and this particular type of attention called rhythmic attention, which is quite a new idea. So a lot of people probably haven't ever heard about it before, but it's looking at attention on a micro temporal scale, so on really small time scales of about 200 milliseconds, which is about a fifth of a second, and seeing how does attention move on those really fine scales. And over the last couple of decades, there's been a fair bit of interest in this, and some researchers have done some really well-designed experiments, and they've found that actually our attention does vary on those timescales. So there's actually a definite sort of rhythm to attention that runs at about that one-fifth of a second kind of pulse, where you can see variability in people's, you know, the sort of stuff that they'll notice or how much information they'll take in that kind of peaks about, you know, 200 milliseconds, and then peaks again about 400 and peaks again like that.
Discussions about this before, but how do you measure attention?
Yeah, well, that's the really tricky thing. And it gets into a field called psychophysics, which is a branch of psychology which looks at perceptual kind of thresholds. So it's the field of psychophysics that tells us things like how much color variation will be needed before you'll decide that a color is red as opposed to orange, for example. You know, just by creeping it up slowly, doing it hundreds and hundreds of times, and then the person reports it's orange, or a sound. You know, where you're just playing a sound really, really quietly, and they don't report anything, and then all of a sudden they report they heard a sound. So you're sort of finding out what their perceptual thresholds are. So that's psychophysics.
And
it gets much more complicated than that. And in that field of psychophysics, we found, or some researchers found, ways that they can actually look at attention on that timescale with really well-designed perceptual experiments.
Okay.
It's amazing to think that you can tell the difference between different millisecond phases
of how well you're perceiving things. It's kind of astonishing, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I think there's some really brilliant work has been done in this area. I actually did my undergraduate, my honours thesis on another field of psychophysics, time perception. So I was sort of familiar with, you know, how difficult it is to do psychophysical mm-hmm. research. And really, you know, this is sort of next level in terms of how sophisticated these research paradigms are.
And so just to be clear, you were looking at rhythmic attention. What was your actual quest? What was the thing that you were trying to find out?
Well, that's a bit of a long story. I don't want to end up still here in an hour sort of just telling you this much. But I was originally interested in consciousness. So I came to kind of consciousness and attention, like how are those two things kind of connected? And that's what I wanted to do for my undergraduate thesis. But luckily, I kind of got talked out of that and did something a little easier.
That's a career right there.
Yeah. And then after I did my undergraduate degree, here in Australia, you do an honours and then you do your actual training to become a psychologist as a master's degree. And I could have gone, you know, down the research sort of rabbit hole and become, you know, a researcher, and or I could have gone off and trained as a psychologist, and those two things sort of tossed up in my mind for a while, and I ended up going down the psychologist training route. So I never got to sort of follow that kind of question to where I wanted to take it. So then this was when I got to the end of my psychology training, we also have to do a slightly shorter thesis, and I thought, well, this is probably a good opportunity for me to at least, you know, answer a little bit of this question that I had, maybe pick a low-hanging fruit in the area of rhythmic attention research and just find out what are the overlaps between rhythmic attention and ADHD. Do they kind of speak to each other in any way? So it was a very broad question that I really wanted to keep as open as possible so that I would capture any connection at all.
And what you did was a review of existing papers, just to be clear.
Yeah, that's correct. And a lot of the, initially I did a narrative review, and then unfortunately my supervisors told me you actually have to do a systematic review as well. You can't get away with just doing a narrative review, which I was very annoyed about because I was very busy at the time. And so then I had to, you know, actually set up some, a systematic review is a fair bit more intensive than a narrative review, and I had to set up a specific question and go through the research. And so the paper that you've read is a combination of those two, the narrative and the systematic. I enjoyed the narrative review much more than I enjoyed the systematic review, as you can probably guess.
Yeah, I'm just briefly pausing. I mean, effectively, a narrative review, just to be really simplistic for kind of lay audience, is basically you will go through and you'll find things just instinctive that almost instinctively are useful and interesting to your question, and you'll look through in that way and you'll follow links and rabbit holes to kind of find, you know, what's actually interesting to you. But a systematic review, you have to be
systematic.
You have to, you know, write a question, find everything in the entire literature which pertains to that question. So it's a much more labor intensive way of going about reviewing the literature, but it's considered more robust, it's fair to say, isn't it?
Much more robust, yeah, because you have to demonstrate that you've actually covered all of the literature and that there isn't anything, you know, that's been hidden in a corner that you didn't see that might maybe, you know, disprove your thesis.
Yeah. Okay. So our next question is, what did you find in your multiple analyses?
Well, the most interesting thing for me that I found was actually came out of the narrative review. And that was, I probably should backtrack. And there's the element of electrophysiology as well that I probably should explain, where a lot of the research that had been done rhythmic attention was actually EEG studies. So, you know, where you're connecting all those electrodes to people's brains and measuring the brainwave patterns. And sort of correlating that with these psychophysical paradigms that I was talking about before, to try and find out, is that brainwave activity varying on a similar scale to the way that the person's performance on the perceptual task is performing, is varying. And they did find very good correlations between that. And the a lot of the ADHD research as well has looked at brainwave patterns. There's a lot of research there in looking at EEG. And so I thought, well, probably a way into looking at this, to finding a link between these two, is actually looking at these EEG studies and trying to find out whether, you know, either of them are, or they're sort of describing similar things. So in the narrative review, I looked at three different types of EEG study, and I found there that there was this trend in both of theta range variations. So in the rhythmic attention literature, as I've mentioned before, it's at about a 200 millisecond kind of peak, so every 200 milliseconds, and that comes out to about what they call the theta range in EEG. So that's about seven cycles a second, seven to 10 cycles a second.
Four to eight. Yes, it's probably worth just briefly pausing, and that there's a lot to be said about EEG interpretation, but broadly speaking, there's a number of different. If you look at the wiggly lines on an EEG, probably most people have seen it, and if you haven't seen it, just Google it very quickly. There's a number of different wiggly lines, and what they do is they pick out the frequency and amplitude, i.e. the depth of all of the different lines that are going on, that are almost like patterns superimposed upon each other to make this picture, in a sense. I mean, I know I'm simplifying things. And so the theta waves are patterns that can be extracted from the noise of waves which are around the same frequency as we're talking about with attention. So,
yes.
Go, carry on.
Yeah, and that was the key finding in the EEG ADHD literature. We have to be careful we don't drown in acronyms. Is that ADHD is associated with this stronger theta signal.
Okay.
Especially in the front of the brain. And what the rhythmic attention research found is that rhythmic attention is also associated with a theta sort of level variation, or theta rate variation in attentional acuity. And the that theta rhythm, when they looked at the whole brain, they were finding it's more in the front of the brain where they're seeing that theta rhythm that's associated, and that tends to be time-locked to that variation in perceptual acuity.
Yes.
Okay. I mean, so there's a lot of big words in
there's
there.
There's this rhythm, this brainwave rhythm in the brain called the theta, which seems to lock with when your attention is up or down over the course of that. If you think about 1 second of experience, the theta wave that is in your brain seems to be reflecting how high or low your attention is at that particular millisecond.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Brilliant. And then when you're looking at you're finding the same correlations on a much smaller scale, and that's the rhythmic.
Well, that's the rhythmic attention is basically the up and down of attention, and we're saying that the theta waves are the same as rhythmic attention, that they are they're a graphical representation, an electrical representation.
But that's what I'm saying, because the distinction, I don't know if I've got this wrong, but the distinction I thought was the time scale that you were looking at it on.
The time scale is always at the sort of second level, as in the less than a second, sort of several times a second these things are happening. Yeah.
Okay.
And you're right. The distinction between the different waves is the time scales.
Well, that's what I was saying.
Okay, yeah, sorry. My mistake. Okay, good. Excellent. Okay.
It's good to flesh that out, because it's a really tricky point, and it's really easy to get confused because there's a lot of variables there and a lot of difficult concepts as well.
Okay.
So you guys are doing a good job.
You've said that time theta variability is higher, or you know, there's more theta variability, or there's some distinctive features of theta waves in ADHD. Can you just drill into that a little bit and just say, mm-hmm. well, what is it that's different about the activity in ADHD people, and what does that mean for their attention?
Yeah. So what you said before was really good, Max. We were sort of describing all of these different waves that are happening in the brain, and there's mathematical processes that they do where they kind of extract from all these jiggly lines. They kind of extract what waveforms are the strongest in there, and then they can sort of give a percentage to each kind of frequency of oscillation. So there's software that does that for you, so you don't have to do it yourself. So you wire someone up to an EEG headset and you record EEG for a while, and then it'll tell you, okay, theta is maybe stronger than at this location in the brain, theta's maybe stronger, alpha's a little bit weaker, deltas maybe weaker, and then gamma's the weakest, you know, something like that. So the theta waves are the strongest in this particular part of the brain. And so when you do that to someone with ADHD, you find that their theta signal tends to be stronger. Whereas when you do that, or when you do that with someone with ADHD and compare it with someone who doesn't have ADHD, the person with ADHD will tend to have a stronger theta signal statistically on average. So it's not so overwhelming that, you know, it really jumps out on an individual basis. But when you study lots of people, you see this trend. And that was what I found in the narrative review was, and it's pretty well known that theta does tend to dominate in ADHD in the EEG.
So the idea is that people with ADHDs, the rhythmic attention of people with ADHD is more pronounced. So our attention is more rhythmic than other people's attention. Variability is greater.
Not the variability, just the more pronounced. So that's the conclusion that I drew from that as well, that somehow these peaks are kind of deeper. In terms of, you know, like your actual perceptual experience, you can imagine that, I don't know if you've ever noticed or watched your visual saccades happening. That's your eyes kind of tend to sort of search around. If you walk into a new room.
Nice way of describing what saccades is, if you watch somebody watching a train go by, their eyes will go flick, 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 flick,
right,
as they kind of retrack onto the whatever they're looking at.
Yeah. Or, you know, if you sit someone down in front of a novel image that they haven't seen before, their eyes will search around that. And those visual saccades tend to happen at about that same kind of theta rate. So you can actually notice by watching those saccades how much information you take in with each little snapshot that you take from the picture. So later on in the paper, I sort of got, you know, stuck into that idea where also linking it with the idea of something called it's dropped out of my brain. Thinking about where people are really like getting really super hyper focused. That's the word that I'm trying to find. In hyper focus, the whole world sort of tunnels in.
Yeah.
And you're not really aware of what's going on around you.
Yeah,
so you
yeah,
can
yeah.
think of that as being like a really, that those peaks are really, really high. And there's not really a lot of space for other stuff to kind of be coming into the picture. And that's definitely something that we anecdotally and the research does tell us that is.
Yeah, because again, anecdotally, there is sort of the idea that people with ADHD can extract a lot of information visually very quickly,
mm-hmm. yeah.
from a map or from a diagram or something, just going boom, 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 boom. Okay, got it. move on. Do you think that that is could be related to this greater depth of the peaks and troughs of rhythmic attention?
Yeah, that was what I where I was kind of heading in terms of the way I was kind of understanding the results of this narrative review. But I didn't really draw that out. Actually, in the actual the one that I submitted and got marked, I really drew that out. But through the process of submission, a lot of that stuff kind of got taken out of the paper just to make it a bit more readable and a little bit less theoretical.
But that was sort of your implication in a sense.
Yeah, when my original kind of question was sort of looking at, I don't know if you've heard of a theory of consciousness called integrated information theory, which is the idea that consciousness and information are somehow two sides of the same coin. So the way that the brain actually creates consciousness is through this thing that they call integrated information. It's one of the sort of all the different theories of consciousness and what makes consciousness, that's one of the most commonly kind of discussed ones. And I was sort of interested in how that that information that becomes consciousness is actually shaped across the perceptual field in terms of describing attention, you know, like the density of that information. So attention sort of describes a kind of a dense area in the center of your whole perceptual field where you've got a lot of information concentrated in a small amount of space. And to me, those kind of theta peaks were sort of telling me something about that. But it would be a PhD.
More of an intensity of attention rather than deficit, which is really interesting in a way.
Yeah.
Because it's completely opposite to how we think of ADHD as a kind of deficit of sustained attention. But what you're saying is that, in a sense, potentially, the attention is more intense, just kind of, I don't know.
Which is why it's a superpower.
Go on.
Which is why it's a superpower.
Yeah, but I suppose the question is therefore, is there anything, because we can kind of explain the ability of ADHD people to really take in information really quickly on the basis of these theta waves, in a sense, we can connect to that. Can we connect to the problems with attention? I mean, because I can't deny that there are problems with attention in ADHD.
Oh, for sure.
So is there any connection between what you found in around the theta waves and the increased depth of those and the problems with attention in ADHD? I mean, that might be a step too far, but.
Well, I think it's a really good question. This was outside of the scope of this paper, just because all I was really looking for was, you know, what are the connections that just a very early scoping review kind of thing, and then forced to, you know, get back into the nitty gritty and really dig into a few papers that when in the narrative review doesn't really give a very conclusive answer. There isn't really a very clear picture. But just a big problem is that a lot of the research on ADHD has been conducted on children. Whereas all of the research on rhythmic attention has been conducted on adults. So there wasn't really a lot of research that I could sort of draw where I was actually looking at specific overlaps there. So the narrative review didn't really give me a very clear picture. But that's definitely a question that I would like to answer myself. I think, you know, when you're thinking about, you know, like a lot more information being contained in attention, you're also thinking that that's probably going to be much harder to control. It's going to require a lot more skill to control that. And that's where possibly some of the problems come in for folks.
That's a really good point, isn't it? Because it's almost an overwhelm. And overwhelm it's almost too much because there's so much going into your brain that you're not necessarily able to pay attention to
any one thing
or particularly something that's less stimulating
because
there's so much else there, and you've got this, I know I keep going on about the hungry brain, but it kind of fits with the hungry brain, doesn't it? They're kind of the more intense attention fluctuations may lead to more intense need for that to be fed in some sense, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's very speculative, but it's interesting how I think that might be why when I read the paper and saw the paper, I was like, oh yeah, I really want to talk about this.
Thanks.
I think that might be part of it. It's tantalizing, isn't it? It sort of goes to potentially one of the fundamental things about the condition, but we're not quite there yet.
Mm. And it is a very speculative paper, so you can be forgiven for speculating.
Good.
Because I think the whole idea of it is to really feed speculation and get people thinking about, you know, something that not many people have thought about before.
Yeah. I think that leads on to our third question.
Exactly.
What does this mean for people looking after ADHD people? So that can be, you know, you talked about a lot of research being conducted on children. That can be teachers during school. That can be psychotherapists.
Yeah. And yeah. So, I mean, I think speculating what might differences in rhythmic attention mean for teachers and clinicians?
Well, I think understanding how detailed the problem of attention actually is, we often will talk of attention as if it's this kind of continuous thing that works over, you know, minutes or hours. You know, that person just didn't pay much attention to my whatever it was that I said, you know, that took maybe a minute. There was maybe a sentence that I said and they didn't pay any attention to it. But actually that person might have jumped in and out of that sentence like 20 times. Mm. And during that time, they might have jumped in and out of like five other different things.
I don't know what you mean.
Yeah, you know, familiar picture, isn't it? And so for the person listening, you know, or for the person talking, they're seeing your eyes shooting around all over the place and seeing how you've only picked up certain pieces of the information they've told you. And they'll say, you're not listening to me, but really you're listening very intently, but you're only getting snapshots. Mm. And so if you can maybe repeat that a few more times, they'll get more of it. Which is, you know, what the recommendations are, but also, if that person can learn to just keep, like, you know, take a little few of those other things out of the picture that they're also processing at the same time, you know, just like all these things happen sort of, they're not outside of our awareness, but we don't actually have the language to explain what's going on. So, we can't sort of intuit, you know, exactly what's going on to that sort of level. But once you actually start watching these processes happening, then you can get a little bit more control over them and maybe pull a couple of the things that you're trying to process at the same time out of the picture so that you've got maybe 60% of your resources going into what the person's telling you rather than only 20 or 30, which you often can get away with.
And also specifically in like a teaching environment, it might be good to just like have the information like written up on a board somewhere so that it's constant. Because I know it's happened to me so many times where I've zoned out while the teacher has been giving a conversation, has been giving like instructions. And maybe I've been zoning in and out. I've caught a little bit, but not enough. And then I'm too embarrassed to ask what I'm supposed to be doing because they just told us.
You just need one piece of information, but if you ask a question, they explain the whole thing again and you look like an idiot.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then I might not even get it that second time, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, in my job, I've done hundreds of classroom observations diagnostically, and I'm not there to examine the teacher, obviously. But the thing that always strikes me is how long teachers require quite young children to listen to, because the instructions need to be quite long because they're quite precise. So do this and then do this and then do this and don't do that and remember to do that and blah 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 blah. And they go, you know, these are like 6-year-olds kind of looking at them going, what? So it's not, I just don't think it's a massive surprise that people struggle to retain long pieces of verbal information. Don't.
No, and everybody's attention is scattered to a certain extent. And when you're talking about, you know, young people, that's even more the case. So, you know, we're not only talking about ADHD here. It's something that probably everybody experiences to some certain degree.
Yeah, of course. This is a question of degree and it becoming pathological is the wrong word, maladaptive for some people, mm-hmm. it becomes more a problem.
Mm. I mean, we've already had some sort of like speculation already about you talking about how this can impact, you know, your lack of attention.
Mm.
But how would you say that? What would you say that this means for ADHD people themselves?
Well, it's pretty similar, but luckily for the ADHD person themselves, they can actually watch these processes happening in real time. So then you get once you get an insight into how much processing you're doing and how quickly you're doing it, that can really help you to get in there and really start, you know, working with the mechanisms. In a more direct way. Also, there are some quite kind of controversial treatments that claim to be able to change these sort of brainwave patterns. I haven't had a chance to look at them enough to be able to, you know, say yay or nay. I know that...
Are people doing biofeedback?
Yeah, neurofeedback, that whole kind of field.
Do you want to explain what that is? I feel like I've talked a lot.
Well, I have to be careful because I don't really know that much about it. But basically the idea is that you're connected to an EEG machine and you're given tasks that help to teach your brain to reduce certain brainwave frequencies and increase others. So it's because ADHD, the association between ADHD and theta is pretty well established, a lot of these will target theta and try and bring down the strength of the theta. So it's basically you might hear some nice music, and when your brain starts producing, you know, over a certain threshold of theta, the music turns into a nasty noise, and then I'm completely making this up, by the way. So anyone who actually does neurofeedback is probably or maybe they're playing a computer game, you know, and when your brain starts generating too much theta, it doesn't work or something.
Your rocket starts to fall apart or something.
Something like that, yeah. So yeah. Then the brain slowly learns. Oh, I get rewarded if I bring theta down a little bit. Anecdotally, these have people have told me before that they've found these kinds of treatments really effective.
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to go back. We probably need to do an episode with something about neurofeedback because it's something that has had its day in the sun in ADHD terms a few years ago. And I think one of the problems was when they did, so anecdotally, as you say, on an individual basis, some people find it really helpful. But I think if you apply it broadly without personalizing it to the individual, then the studies lose their ability to show benefit because they're almost too robust and too uniform in their intervention. And there's some emerging stuff which I've read some of about how actually personalizing neurofeedback is a way potentially to make it more effective. So I think it's something we're still, I mean, obviously this is not a podcast for clinic for that is in any way trying to give any sort of clinical advice, but I think it's still the jury's definitely out on neurofeedback, but there are some new approaches that are quite promising. I think we would say that.
Mm. Yeah, I think we've still got a lot to learn and we've still got a lot to learn about EEG in general, you know, like the you know what the signals are actually telling us, and whether we can actually localize a signal is also quite controversial.
Specifically with an EEG, I mean, obviously I have a very primitive understanding of this, but I remember when I was doing my psychology A level, one of the you know, it wasn't listed as a benefit of the EEG that you could localize any sort of brain signals really to any specific area of the brain.
Yes, no, I think it's not generally effective.
Well, yeah,
you get the different electrodes in different parts of the brain. So,
but is that something that you can do to a scientific level, localize with an EEG?
Which is a a really controversial question, I think, and that's why you're in some, from some people tell you can, some people tell you can't.
I think just to be clear, from a sort of clinical pediatric point of view, yes, you can. If you have a seizure, you know, because that's what they're really they're for. Well, they're originally for detecting seizure activities. So
yeah.
If you're having fits and you want to know what part of the brain those are coming from, where the signal's coming from, so is it temporal lobe epilepsy? Is it partial epilepsy? Is it generalized epilepsy? It is really good for that.
Mm-hmm.
That is broad brush. Where's the really, if you look at seizure activity on an EEG, it looks completely different to the normal resting EEG. So for that broad brush, really big stuff, is really good localization.
Yep. It's good enough for that.
Localization for more subtle, maybe more psychologically relevant things rather than the seizure, just to be clear.
Yes. Yeah, like can you actually pinpoint a particular structure in the brain and say this particular frequency is coming from that structure deep in the brain. Some people say you can, and some people say there's no way that's going to be possible because of conduction effects. And there's all sorts of really sophisticated mathematics that are way too complex for me to understand that you have to sort of wade through to sort of clarify that whole kind of question.
Mm. Were you going to say something?
I thought you were.
No, I was going to ask you about the electrical signals that seizures produce, but I feel like we've moved on from that now.
Yeah, I mean, they're just basically, they're huge and jagged, essentially. Yeah,
it's a sudden spread of strong electrical signals throughout the brain.
Yeah, and they're chaotic,
the
seizure. Rather than having these nice, smooth waveforms, seizure activity typically is quite chaotic, which goes along with what you see in the person when they're having the seizure. But that's a whole epilepsy thing. So we just, I'm actually not much of an expert on epilepsy anyway. So we should probably move on before I embarrass myself or my pediatric neurology colleagues going, "What are you talking about, Max?"
It is interesting from the point of view of consciousness, because seizure is often associated with loss of consciousness. And interestingly, this one of the characteristics of the EEG and seizure is that you get widespread coherence through the brain, where all of the parts of the different parts of the brain actually go into lockstep.
Yeah.
And for some reason that just wipes out all activity, and which really makes sense in terms of, the kind of current sort of understanding of what these oscillations are doing is that it's the brain is different parts of the brain that are actually communicating with each other. And so that they can't all be saying exactly the same thing. Otherwise you haven't actually got any information passing. Huh.
And that supports the whole consciousness being about information integration.
It's
consistent with that.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the pieces of evidence that they bring to the table.
Huh. Oh, that's interesting.
It is interesting.
So I'm going to jump in with the last question, because I know that you're not currently engaged in research, Andrew, because you're doing proper work, actual clinical work with rehab and massage. What do you think, if you were to, or what would you advise somebody who's coming after you? What do you think people should be looking at next in this field?
Yeah, I definitely found a few really interesting things. I still kind of am very curious about this field, and I do kind of actively follow kind of research in the field of consciousness. Particularly, so that's more my area of interest, and I imagine I've been interested in that since I was a kid, so I will probably be interested in that till the day I die. The few things that kind of came out of this particular research was there was one thing that actually didn't really make it into the paper, where there was quite a lot of really interesting research into peak alpha rhythm. And sort of when I started looking into it, I found there wasn't really a lot of research in the ADHD field. So and there was a lot of controversy and a lot of different questions, and I started trying to explain it, and it just, my word count blew out, and I ended up having to take all of that out of the paper. But I would probably, if I was going to dive back into this again, I would probably dive back in there, because I'm, to me, like this, if this sort of, if attention is sort of does work in these sort of rhythmic pulses, and attention is actually something, has something to do with consciousness, and you know, obviously a big part of what the brain does is generate consciousness, if you believe consciousness is a thing that exists, which some people don't. So if you're sort of in that camp, then you've got to ask the question, okay, so if attention and consciousness are so sort of deeply intermingled, then we should, when we look at the brain and the rhythmic activity of the brain, we should be seeing a really clear signal. And that's the question that I, or the reason I actually went to this research in the first place, was expecting to find a really clear signal. There wasn't really a really clear signal.
But yeah,
having come away from it now, and sort of thought about it for a few years, that the idea of the alpha peak frequency seems to me to be the most sort of promising area to sort of look in, because that is actually the peak signal. That's when the brain was sort of first looked at, the electrophysiology of the brain was first looked at the beginning, I think, of the 20th century. The first thing they found was alpha, and that's why they called it alpha. The alpha peak is the strongest signal that the brain produces. And when I did wade into that, you know, there's lots of different ideas about why that is and what function that plays in the brain. And I think if I had, you know, a few years to wade back into this topic again, I'd probably try and wade into that area.
Not a specific ADHD question, but a question of consciousness and how that relates to different waveforms within the EEG. So the alpha being a different form.
The alpha is just a little bit faster. I think we're looking at sort of between 8 and 14 hertz. So that's a little bit faster than what most of the rhythmic attention has found. Rhythmic attention research has found, but it's possible that that might actually be kind of something else that we've missed as well, that actually we're not getting all of the pulses in these psychophysics paradigms, because the brain is just doing so much else. You know, it's doing self-awareness and interception, as well as attending to whatever task is being given out there. So it might actually be that there's extra pulses that we don't see in a psychophysics experiment that would, you know, bring it up into the alpha range. But that's very speculative. That's just where I'd go if I was looking into it again.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing, because actually, in a way, EEG is quite, not primitive, but it's quite a simple technology, isn't it? You're just literally measuring electrical activity. Do you know what I mean? It's not...
Yeah.
So fascinating. You can really dig into it in this sort of world of dynamic brain activity. I think it's quite underrated. I mean, I have to say, it's not a diagnostic tool. We haven't been able to use it as a diagnostic tool, but as a tool for probing the brain, I think it's massively underrated compared to other kind of more fancy things.
And it's so useful in this field, because it gives you really detailed information at really small time scales, which not many of the other ways of looking at the brain actually give you that detail.
That's very good for the time stamping, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Okay, well, I think that's a good, for us in the morning, kind of good, kind of, you know, morning, Sunday morning wake up with a bit of consciousness philosophy.
Consciousness
chat.
Yeah.
I hope it hasn't been too speculative for your audience. Sorry?
So, I mean, for your wind down for your evening.
Yes, definitely. It was a very interesting chat, and I appreciate your very insightful questions. And I'm going to go off and have my dinner while you guys go off and have your breakfast, I imagine.
Yeah, basically, that's literally what's going to happen now. Andrew, thank you very much for joining us, and bye-bye.
It's been great to meet you both. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, so... that's it for the episode for today.
Thank you, Andrew.
Tess, you're going to go back to having a day off.
YouTube and sitting down, because right now I'm standing up.
That's right. Which is basically what you do most of your time now.
Yeah, my full-time job, bartender. Yeah. You know, finally ready to reveal that to you guys, my bartender.
Which is why we're not necessarily doing a huge amount of episodes at the moment. That's one reason anyway, because you are super busy.
Because I'm not awake in the mornings and I'm working in the evenings.
Yeah, exactly. So there will be a few before Christmas. I'm hoping to get a few more out. I've got a couple of recorded. And then it will be Christmas and then we'll have to see. But we hope everyone's well out there in the internet.
Yes.
Please do join our Facebook group, ADHD Science Podcast.
And if you're in the UK, I hope that it snowed at your house.
Yes, it was really quite lovely.
And I hope that that was nice for you.
All right. That's enough waffle. We will see you next time. Not too very much, not very long, because I have got another one in the bag, and we just need to put it out.
Yeah, get ready.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.